Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, Graydon Carter discusses Martin Amis's new novel.
And what he's done is write a novel about what he perceives as the sexual revolution in the 1970s and how it affected women and the sort of the damage that the sexual revolution caused in the lives of many women.
Howard Bryant explores the life and turmoil of baseball great Henry Aaron. Olin Steinhauer's here to talk about his new thriller, The Nearest Exit.
You take your understanding of human nature, and you then think about how you humans put together something like an intelligence agency.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. Martin Amis has been the brilliant bad boy of British letters for a long time. He's got a new novel called The Pregnant Widow. It's reviewed for us by one of the brilliant bad guys of American journalism, Graydon Carter, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Graydon.
Well, thank you very much, Sam.
All right. Amis is actually an extraordinarily gifted writer. What's he up to in this novel?
Well, he says he started off with doing a sort of fiercely autobiographical novel. And he said that he got about 400 pages into it and realized it was not working, and he ditched most of it. And what he's done is write a novel about what he perceives as the sexual revolution in the 1970s and how it affected the men in part, but largely how it affected the women and that the sort of the damage that that the sexual revolution caused in the lives of many women.
Graydon, he has, with his usual wit, said in the novel, he hasn't changed the names to protect the innocent. There were no innocents. Is there a kind of Romanoff Clay aspect? In your review, you suggest that some of the figures in this novel may actually be based closely on actual people.
Well, in the British press sort of went to town trying to figure out who was what. And I think the writers, when they add a layer of Romanoff Clay onto a book, I think they want to have the guessing game going on, and I think they think it'll spur interest in the book and readers. Most of them are English figures, and I mean, in the case of, say, Tamsin Day Lewis, Daniel Day Lewis's sister, who's a cookbook writer, she came out of the closet and said that she thought she was the basis for one of the characters, Scheherazade, who is sort of leggy, bosomy, very attractive 20-year-old in the book. It doesn't add much to it for an American reader, and I suppose it adds a little bit for a British reader, because he says it isn't a Romanoff Clay except for the character that's very much like his sister.
And Graydon, you say that although The Pregnant Widow is about sex, there really isn't all that much sex in it.
Right. I said you could find more sex in a Republican romance novel. No, I don't even like reading about sex. I'm Canadian, so it's a subject that's best left undone. It's not a saucy bodice ripper at all. It's a lot of yearning and fantasizing. For some people, they may find that incredibly unpleasing. I mean, he does have the talented these amazing sort of riffs that are interspersed in the book. It all takes place in Italy over a course of a summer at a beautiful castle.
And it's set in 1970?
1970.
Yeah.
Right on the cusp of the pill's been invented. And it's basically, his theory was it gave women, the pill and the sexual revolution gave women the right to enjoy sex the way men did. But then for so many of them, they didn't know when the music was going to stop, and they continued on, destroyed their lives in many respects. They didn't have the children they wanted to have, that it caused a lot of hardship and later discomfort in their lives. And I'm not sure whether he proves the point, but that is his stated intention in part with the book.
So he's something of a moralist in the end. For all the reputation, as you say, the Mick Jagger of British letters, he has a very sort of traditional moral view of the novel and of society.
Well, it's funny because he said that his sister, who died a few years ago, was, he said, definitely a victim of the sexual revolution. He sort of wished she had taken up Islam or something like that. He says sometimes these really structured societies might be better for women, which I'm not sure how that is going to go over with people who read the book. But I'm not sure whether he's a moralist, but I suppose most novelists are moralists to a certain extent.
You happened to be in London when when this novel was published there, right? Or around the time?
Well, you know, and I've been in London when a previous Amos books come out, and they're like Apple iPad launches. I mean, they're very well structured. You will, if you're there for 3 days during this period, you will see a feature on him in every one of the broadsheets. And then the reviews come out, and they do follow, I sort of describe this a bit, they do follow a pattern. Invariably, the reviews, he says something outrageous in one of the interviews, and at least one of the interviews. And then you get a news story the next day. And in the case of this book, he suggested that we're about to, in Britain especially, is about to have this sort of silver tsunami of old people who will be bringing society down, and that he suggests that they have sort of charming little euthanasia booths on the corners of most London streets where you can have a martini and then sort of move on to the next stage. Then the reviews invariably, you go back and look at it, they invariably say, go back over the dreadful reviews of the previous book and say how much they hope that this one will be a return to old Martin Amis, the Martin Amis of the funny Martin Amis, the one of dead babies and money and the Rachel papers. And then invariably they're slightly disappointed that that is not the case with whatever book they're writing about.
Okay, great. And so to perpetuate this game that Amis is a part of and maybe doesn't always enjoy, there seems to be a long-running debate, a competition between Martin Amis and his extremely gifted and successful father, Kingsley Amis, the novelist. Is that competition still part of the literary conversation now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Kingsley, Martin's 60 now, and Kingsley is, at 64 wrote The Old Devils and won the Booker. So Martin still has some time to catch up with his father.
Has he not won the Booker Prize ever, Martin
no.
Amis?
You know, his first books were probably so raw and so novel that they were not considered in that way. They want something safer generally. And by the time he became safer, if in fact he ever did become safe, he's been overlooked. I think that he went into the family trade, which is very unusual in the world of letters. You have musicians following their parents and artists following their parents and actors following their parents. But it's really rare to have a literary dynasty. It just doesn't happen all that often. And he got the benefit of it at the beginning of his career because it probably did help, despite his great sort of talented flourishes with the language. But I think it's starting to wear on him now. And it's funny, I saw a picture of him in the New York Post last weekend, and my God, he starts looking like his father. He even brushes his hair like his old man now.
Thanks a lot, Graydon.
Great pleasure.
That's Graydon Carter, who reviews Martin Amis' new novel, The Pregnant Widow, on the cover of this week's book review. Henry Aaron was one of America's greatest baseball players, maybe the greatest hitter who ever lived, best known for breaking Babe Ruth's home run record. There's an important new biography of him. It's called The Last Hero, A Life of Henry Aaron. It's by Howard Bryant, and it's reviewed, wait for it, by me. A fantastic book. I wrote about it, maybe at too much length, but I'm so delighted that the author is here to talk about it. Welcome, Howard Bryant.
Same. Thanks for having me.
All right, Henry Aaron, give us briefly the story. It's really a great American story. Kid from deepest Jim Crow South becomes maybe one of the two or three greatest baseball players ever. How did you get onto this story?
Well, it's funny for me, after my second book, Juicing the Game, which was pretty much about the steroid era that came out in 2005, I was so, I don't know if disgusted is the word for it, but I was just thinking so much about where we were at this in this place in our country, and especially with the steroid era, with all these players would tell me all the time, if you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. And that was one of the things that really kind of bothered me about where we were. And I started to really think about, was there anybody out there that kind of exemplified the game as I wanted to think it existed at some point? Henry Aaron to me was the guy, mostly because here was a player that hadn't been written about very much. And now you had all of these players using these performance-enhancing drugs, and the one person that everybody wanted to hear from was Henry Aaron. What does Henry think about this? And even Jim Bunning and a lot of the old players would say, talk to Henry about it.
And this was partly, Howard, because Aaron had done what many thought was impossible, which was to break Babe Ruth's career home run record. And now Barry Bonds, who's probably the greatest player of his era, but engorge with steroids is going to break Aaron's own record.
That's right.
So he became the guy.
That's right. And he became – and that's why I called him the last hero, because when you think about the records, that home run record was the last home run record that wasn't tainted by steroids, that wasn't tainted by this performance-enhancing drug culture. And when that record fell in August of 07, there was nothing left. And I think that Dr. Harry Edwards, the great sociologist, once said that you're going to have two people now. One is the record holder, and the other is the standard bearer. Barry Bonds holds the record. He has a number. That's it. Henry Aaron remains to be the standard. That distance, that gap, is something that we've never seen before in professional sports.
Okay, Howard, but there's a huge irony or paradox in this, which is that Henry Aaron belonged to that remarkable wave of African-American ballplayers who – followed by just an eyelash, Jackie Robinson into Major League Baseball, but he was playing in what was in many ways still a segregated game. Talk about the locker room in the Milwaukee Braves where Aaron played. This was a revelation to me.
Well, the amazing thing about doing this project was finding out all kinds of things that you didn't know about segregation. And one of the things that had bothered me as a youngster, as a 41-year-old who didn't have to deal with the things that Henry Aaron had to deal with, was I think our generation looks at segregation as two separate water fountains, or you couldn't go to school with white kids or whatever, and that's it. But that's not really what I wanted to get at. What I wanted to get at was what was it like on a day-to-day basis in terms of these certain codes. And I was talking with Gene Conley, the great pitcher, who still has the distinction of being the only person in professional sports to win a World Series and an NBA championship.
With the Boston Celtics.
With the Boston Celtics. And he was telling me about how close he was to Bill Russell and how Bill Russell was so central in breaking down so many of the racial stereotypes. And then I began to ask him, well, what was the Braves clubhouse like? And he would tell me how when you would walk into the Braves clubhouse, you'd have this corner of the three or four black players on the team, and they would be separate from the other players. But most insidiously is that the black players had to wait until the white players were done taking a shower. So the team didn't even shower together. And I was thinking about what that meant to a young Henry Aaron, 20 years old, and just realizing that this is a daily humiliation that you can't even articulate because that's how it is. And for him, having no idea that it would ever change. You think you made it. You think you're in the big leagues. You think that you're one of everyone. You're at the top, but you're really not. You're still at the bottom.
And talk about Aaron's background. It's not as if he didn't know what Jim Crow was all about.
Exactly. Coming from Mobile, and that was one of the great tensions of the book, when it took 2 years for Henry Aaron to even talk to me. I wanted to get him. I started this project in May of 2006, and he and I didn't have a conversation, ironically, until January 31st, 2008, Jackie Robinson's birthday. And for me, the question that I had for him was, which vision of America won for him? Was it the vision of being from Mobile, born in 1934, when his dad would go into a hardware store and he would have to give up his place in line to someone white? Or was it the vision of today, where he's a 76-year-old man and you've got an African-American in the White House? He's slept at the White House. He's met presidents and dined with kings and queens, in which
– he was quite friendly with Bill Clinton.
And very
Wasn't
friendly with Bill Clinton,
Wasn't he fairly important
yes.
in Clinton's career?
In 1992, sure. He held a rally for him that Bill Clinton still says turned around the 92 race. But I realized that it was an unfair question to ask of Henry Aaron, because both visions are equal parts of his life. And there's a piece of him, as he always says, that he won't get back, not because he didn't have success, but because of all the Aaron men that came before him who never got to be what they wanted to be simply because they were born black in the South.
Howard, let's talk about the event that made Aaron so huge in so many people's lives, including me as a teenager, when he began the tremendous assault that lasted years, really, on Babe Ruth's home run record. Here was Aaron playing in the first major league team really located in Old Dixie, the Atlanta Braves, when the team moved there. What was the reaction among white America when this African American from the Deep South was going to take the crown away from Babe Ruth?
As you know, here's a good question for journalists. How do you write about something that's been written about so much? And I was trying to find the way to get at April 8th, 1974, when he broke Babe Ruth's record. How do you say something new about this subject? And what I wanted to do was to try to talk to the white players talk to the white players about their America. Talk to everybody who was there that night, as many people as I could, about their America. Because so many times when people want to talk about race, they always ask the black guy, ask the African-American guy what it was like for him. So what I tried to do was talk to all the players that night who were on the field about what their America was coming in and what that night meant to them. And it was really fascinating listening to these ball players because they come from so many different places. You have someone like Tom House who comes from Seattle talking about what it was like for him out there and how different it was for someone like Al Downing, who grew up in Maryland but was still considered the South.
And he was the pitcher.
And he was the pitcher that night who threw the home run ball. And what you found was that Jimmy Wynn was the one who said it best, where he said that what you found was that with every other record, these records belonged to white America. Henry Aaron was giving us something that finally belonged to us. And it was fascinating to me that you had so many different feelings. These guys are supposed to be playing a game right now, but it's all happening in real time. And I was just fascinated listening to their stories because it was a time, an extremely divisive time, where you had to realize that there was something new taking place, that full partnership in this country didn't just mean being allowed to play. It meant being allowed to excel and to be embraced by parts of the population that weren't used to embracing you.
Tell us about Henry Aaron now. He's 76 years old. He's a wealthy man living in Atlanta. What does he do? What's he like? You got to know him.
Well, he's still in the Atlanta Braves organization. He's an executive there. And it, like I said, it took a long time to get him to talk. And when I finally got to talk to him that night in January of 2008, I asked him essentially for his blessing. I wanted him to contribute to the book if he wanted to help. It was an unauthorized book. But I didn't want him to make that phone call that all biographers dread, which is, hey, there's this guy writing a book about me. Don't talk to all of his people. And when we spoke, he was extremely gracious. He was extremely kind. And he was wounded. And he said, nobody cares about me. I don't know why you're doing this. And he was very convinced that what the only thing that people cared about was either the night he broke the record, which was one of the worst nights of his life, actually, or Barry Bonds. And it was fascinating once more that I said, do you really believe that this is what people think about you? You are an American icon. And he said, no one cares about me. They only care about what I hit on a 3-2 pitch or what home run I hit off what guy, or if I'm going to say something explosive about Barry Bonds.
Thanks a lot, Howard.
My pleasure.
That's Howard Bryant, whose book, The Last Hero, A Life of Henry Aaron, is reviewed in this week's book review. Olin Steinhauer has emerged as one of the best thriller writers in the English language. He has a new book. It's called The Nearest Exit and features his hero, Milo Weaver. It's reviewed for us this week by Joshua Hammer, who says that like John le Carré's George Smiley, Milo Weaver is a richly imagined creation with a scarred psyche and a complex backstory. He also praises Steinhauer's brisk pacing, sharp dialogue, and convincing evocation of a paranoid subculture. I'm delighted that Olin is here to talk about his book. Welcome.
And thank you.
Set us up here. Who is Milo Weaver and what's his problem?
Well, Milo Weaver, it's always referred to as a reluctant spy, and I think that's what he is. In the first book, The Tourist, you saw the end of his career as a field agent.
For the CIA.
For the CIA. It's a special kind called a tourist, which is, I mean, in a way, it's sort of a joke. I mean, I made up this idea of tourists because I live overseas. I'm an expat, and I'm always interested in the idea of not being connected to where you are. And so I kind of extended that idea into this idea of these spies who move around constantly and have no stable place that they would call home. And as an expat, I sometimes feel that way. By putting it into a spy's world, it kind of increases the tension, the mental instability for these characters. So The Tourist opens with his last day as a tourist. He's suicidal. It's all finished for him. As you learn in The Tourist, ends up getting a second life as a desk man. And through these books, he keeps getting pulled back away from this family life that he's built for himself, keeps getting pulled back into tourism, which is not where he wants to be.
So what happens in the new novel? What plight is he in now?
Well, as a result of events in The Tourist, he's now actually working as a tourist again. And he essentially wants to find his way back out of it.
Now, where is he? Where is this set?
Well, this is set in a lot of places. It starts off in Zurich. He's doing an art robbery from an art museum. It's actually based on a real robbery from the E.G. Burrell Museum. It happened in 2007. It was the most valuable art theft in Swiss history, or perhaps in European history. Four paintings were stolen, and a few weeks later, two of them reappeared, but the other two were never found. And so within that framework of a real situation, I have Milo doing the robbery and an explanation for why two show up and then two never do. And he moves around. He goes to Berlin, which was actually sort of the crucial beginning, in a way, real beginning of the novel, when he's given the task to kill a 15-year-old girl, a Moldovan immigrant.
The CIA has ordered him to kill a 15-year-old.
Yeah, and the question is why? And he asks himself that. He's not given a reason. He's supposed to do the job and go on. And he has his own idea for why they're doing this. And it's his ego speaking, in a way, because he thinks it's a test for him, that it has no purpose. But as we learn, it does have a purpose as the story goes on.
And who are some of the adversaries he encounters?
Well, he's hounded by one German spy master, in a way, a woman, Erika Schwartz, who's been in the game through the Cold War and is still around. And she's actually hunting for the murderer of this girl. And, of course, that leads her to Milo. That's his initial adversary. But then there's an overarching adversary, becomes more apparent as time goes on, and that's a Chinese spy master who was mentioned in the first book, but comes back with more of a vengeance in this one.
Now, this is an ongoing series, is that right?
Well, it's a trilogy. It's going to be a trilogy. One more book and then...
So do you know where it's going? Do you know?
Vaguely. I don't outline before I write. I could only give a three-sentence summation of the entire trilogy, really. One is CIA pushes against China. Second one, China pushes back. And the third one will be the CIA pushing back. I mean, I can't get much more specific than that.
Well, one of the questions that comes up, and Hammer mentions this, is how does this genre, which achieved a real glory during the Cold War, when it was just so clear that there were these two powerful superpower adversaries, how do you sustain it now in our era?
I mean, you have to think about what made those books great. One thing I do is I don't deal directly with the major sensational issue of the day, which is terrorism. I kind of skirt around that issue, partly because I'm not too sure I have the tools right now to write my terrorist characters particularly well. So I'm kind of sticking to what I think I can pull off. The sort of adversarial climate of the Cold War, I don't think it ever really goes away. I mean, because Russia is no longer the threat it was, and because America has a different stance now, it doesn't mean that nations are not always pushing against each other. I mean, they've been doing it since the beginning of time. I don't see a big difference now. I take my influences really from the 70s, a lot of the Cold War spy novels of that time. Of course, the Le Carre, Charles McCary, Lynn Dayton. It's a typical list. But I take those, and those are my primary inspiration when I sit down and write about now. And I find that I don't have to change as much as you might think to deal with the contemporary world.
Do you know CIA officers?
I mean, honestly, I've met some people at parties and such who I suspect, but no one's ever admitted to it.
So how do you learn what you need to know to depict a CIA operative?
John Le Carre did an interview sort of about knowing this world of intelligence. He always found it slightly amusing that people looked at his books as if they were a blueprint for how intelligence works. And he said, you know, he has no idea how intelligence actually works. You know, he was a spy for a little while, but that was a very limited role.
And a long time ago.
And a very long time ago. And he said, you know, a novelist is an expert only in one thing, and that's himself. And so you take your understanding of human nature, and you then think about how you humans put together something like an intelligence agency. How much of this is calculated? How much of this is run by their own mistakes, by their petty jealousies, by office politics? You start to sort of work all this together with your own idea of human nature. Probably if you read my books, you would think, well, Olin's pretty pessimistic about human nature. And that's probably true. But it works very nicely within the world of espionage to create that sort of world. I would never say this is exactly how espionage works, because I don't know exactly. I mean, I think there are very few people who could say they really know how espionage works.
But in part, it's the enigmatic, mysterious quality of it that enables you to do this.
Which in a way makes it easier, yet at the same time harder, than something like the police procedural, because there are a lot of people who know exactly how police procedure is done. So that gives you flexibility, but it also gives you a huge responsibility to make sure that there's no internal contradictions in this world that you've created, which means you have to really be on top of what you're doing.
Thanks a lot, Olin.
Thank you.
That's Olin Steinhauer, whose new novel, The Nearest Exit, is reviewed in this week's book review. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Something is new. Charlaine Harris is back on top of the fiction list with her latest Sookie Stackhouse Southern vampire novel. It's called Dead in the Family. She knocks James Patterson, poor James Patterson, down to number two.
Battle of the heavyweights.
Yeah. Scott Turow, our cover boy of a couple of weeks ago, enters at number three with Innocent, his long-awaited follow-up to his smash hit Presumed Innocent.
When Scott Turow was here for his interview, I kept on calling him Turow, and then he pronounced it Turow, and I apologized for that. And he said, it's not a problem that his daughter pronounces it Turow. And Scott said, no, we don't say that. We say Turow. And she said, you say Turow.
It's a little bit of a same thing in my family, actually.
What about nonfiction?
Laura Bush, former first lady, lands at number one with her memoir, Spoken from the Heart.
And lands with a thud at number one, right?
Yep.
Speaking of first ladies, you commissioned a back page essay that looks at the entire genre. Is that right?
Yes. It's quite an interesting essay by a writer named Craig Furman. And, there's sort of surprising depths to the subject, you might say. Interestingly, in the 19th century, there were no First Lady memoirs, or at least none that were published. Abigail Adams' letters were published after she had died. They were quite widely read. Louisa Adams, the daughter-in-law of Abigail Adams and the wife of President John Quincy Adams, she made several attempts at an autobiography. Her last try was called The Adventures of a Nobody, and it was not, in fact, published. Julia Grant, she wrote a memoir, but it was never actually published in her lifetime.
This is the wife of Ulysses Grant.
Right.
It was not published in her lifetime?
Not published in her lifetime, amazingly. The first First Lady to see her memoirs published in her lifetime was Helen Taft. Came out in 1914. Woodrow Wilson's wife Edith wrote a memoir. And of course, Eleanor Roosevelt, who's sort of an outlier in every way, wrote many books, including a pretty conventional White House memoir. But the sort of modern mold was really set by Lady Bird Johnson, who, you know, in the days after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, when her husband, you know, became president unexpectedly, decided that she owed history an archive. So she retired to her study just about every night, hung a little pillow on the door that said, I want to be alone, and started writing. She saved menus, papers, all sorts of things. And when her book was ready, there was a big auction among New York publishers, and the book did quite well. Since then, every single lady, with the interesting exception of Pat Nixon, has written a memoir. And quite often, they've been just as successful or more successful than their husband's books. And, you know, I guess sometimes, as perhaps is the case with Laura Bush, they've remained more popular than their husbands. One kind of interesting case was the Fords. They signed a sort of unusual joint book deal for $1 million. So they were, you know, this was the era of the ERA. They were sort of equal partners in book writing.
And Betty Ford was extremely outspoken.
Extremely outspoken, and very frank about her difficulties in life. And her book actually did much better. And apparently on Gerald's 64th birthday in 1977, before their books came out, she gave him a T-shirt that said, I bet my book outsells yours. And she got a big paperback deal, and he just barely got a paperback deal.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Join us again next week on Inside the New York Times Book Review. Remember, there's more at our website, nytimes.com/books. For the New York Times, this is Sam Tannenhaus.